describe Vladimir Putin as, on, you know, some might say concerned about U.S. influence and U.S. expansion of its role, but might some say paranoid? I mean, if this was an event that many in the West saw as important but not huge, but Vladimir Putin took it as, my God, this is happening in Ukraine, I need to react here.
Well, you know, as they say about paranoia, there's always a grain of truth in it. And the United States role, they obviously promote a stable, free Ukraine. And in Russia's view, that is a threat to Russia's influence over Ukraine, a country which has long, obvious connection to Russia. And so, I think he has concerns about what the United States role in the world is generally. And he's been telegraphing that for years now.
So what does Vladimir Putin want? I mean, he got involved in Ukraine, and Crimea, and you say that to kind of control U.S. influence. He's involved in Syria now. Russia seems to be playing a huge role in that conflict. There are these accusations that Russia was involved in trying to determine the outcome of a U.S. presidential election. What is in Putin's mind right now?
I think that the short answer, going back to what the ambassador said, is that relations are at a level that we haven't really seen since the Cold War. And I think that's because Vladimir Putin very much sees the world in a Cold War conflict. At least he sees the relationship with the United States as returning to this great power conflict that we had at that time. It's not ideological as much anymore. The Cold War between capitalism and communism, that's been decided. But nonetheless, he sees Russia having a sphere of influence, having a part of the world where it should be able to dictate terms. And that's obviously in conflict with the way the United States sees the world.
In conflict with the way the United States has seen the world under President Obama, how will that change under President Donald Trump, who seems to be open to a cozier relationship with Vladimir Putin so far?
You know, the fact is since the collapse of the Soviet Union 25 years ago, administrations from both parties have sought a new relationship with Russia, the heir of the Soviet Union. And each presidency has begun with an effort to restart relations.
So you've heard this before, is what you're saying.
Exactly. And in the Obama administration, they called it a reset. And for a while, it worked. There was a marked improvement of relations at the time that Dmitry Medvedev was president and Putin was serving as prime minister. And so I'm sure Donald Trump will not use the word reset, but he's clearly telegraphed a willingness to restart relations with Russia on a different footing. And Vladimir Putin has responded to that positively. There was a letter that he sent just last week talking about a pragmatic and constructive relationship. I think as much as Vladimir Putin wants to vilify the West, he does need to, or at least wants to have an improvement in relations, and he sees an opportunity there with Donald Trump.
A lot of people who are worried about Donald Trump and the relationship with Russia, who have seen Donald Trump as unpredictable, who have been sort of alarmed by the positive comments he has made about Vladimir Putin, who don't know much about Donald Trump's foreign policy, they seem incredibly nervous right now, including across Europe. Are you saying that maybe people are overreacting?
Well, I don't think people are overreacting as much as there's a great deal of uncertainty about what Donald Trump will do as president. It regards Russia, but other parts of the world as well, what the foreign policy will be. I mean, what he's said concretely on policy issues regarding Russia is that it would be great if we could cooperate better with them in the war against the Islamic State. And it remains to be seen, can he negotiate something like that? It's probably will be progress if there is at least an effort to try to improve relations from this low level that we're at now. I mean, you could argue we could only go up. but at the same time, it remains to be seen what kind of agreement they could make, what kind of deal Donald Trump as president will be able to negotiate with Vladimir Putin.
Is this a new Cold War, as some people are calling it?
You know, some people don't like to use the phrase Cold War because of the ideological differences today. But, in terms of the military confrontation, in terms of the economic sanctions that have been posed on Russia, not just by the United States, but also by Europe and other countries, I think it's fair to say that it is a Cold War-like conflict right now.
Okay. Chatting in the studio with New York Times correspondent Stephen Lee Myers, who is also the author of The New Tsar, The Rise and Reign of Vladimir Putin. Stephen, thanks so much for coming in this morning. We appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Okay. So as we reach the end of the year, it seems like it's a nice time to take a step back and get some perspective. And I mean stepping way back and getting some serious perspective, like the scale of the entire universe kind of perspective. My colleague Nell Greenfield-Boyce recently asked scientists some basic questions about the universe. And this week on the show, we'll hear their answers. Today, we start at the beginning, the very beginning.
When I sat down with astrophysicist Chuck Bennett at Johns Hopkins University, I asked him, where did the universe come from?
That happens to be my absolute favorite question.
He says everybody has heard of the Big Bang Theory. It says the universe started out dense and hot and then expanded.
I would state the Big Bang Theory is the universe has been expanding and cooling for 13.8 billion years, period.
Notice he didn't say where the original stuff came from or what happened to set it off.
The Big Bang Theory doesn't actually say what happened right at the beginning.
He says that you can follow our laws of physics back, but they break down close to the start, when things were unspeakably hot and close together. Still, there may be clues from the weird world of quantum physics. In that world, our intuition isn't a good guide. Strange stuff can happen, like particles can just appear out of nowhere.
Even if you take something that's complete vacuum, you've gotten all the particles and dust and everything out of the way, in quantum mechanics, you still have particles popping in and out of existence all the time.
So maybe the kernel that became our universe just randomly and spontaneously appeared.
It seems bizarre, but that is kind of the going thinking about this.
And if you want to think about something even more bizarre, consider this point made by Caltech theoretical physicist Sean Carroll. He says the start of the universe is the start of time itself, which creates a conundrum.
So there's no verbs before time itself exists, right? There's no popping into existence. There's no fluctuating. There's no quantum mechanical craziness. There is literally nothing.
He says it's possible the Big Bang emerged from something else.
That could have been the very first moment in the history of the universe, or it could have come out of something bigger. We just don't know quite yet.
He says, don't be unsettled by the idea that the universe plays by its own rules.
The universe is special. You know, the universe is not the things inside the universe.
It's not like you and me. Nell Greenfield-Boyce, NPR News.
Just tackling some small topics like the universe. Tomorrow we'll tackle whether the universe is infinite and what you might see if you could get into a spaceship and try to fly to its edge. This is NPR News.
And on a Monday morning, it is 8:18, and this is Wisconsin Public Radio. Hope you had the loveliest holiday weekend. Thanks for starting your weekday here, and stay tuned. Headlines are coming up next from NPR and WPR. WPR's Shemaine Mills brings us a story about a way some officials in southeast Wisconsin are trying to track drug abuse better. That story in a couple of minutes.
Support for WGTD comes from Kenosha Winter Harbor Market, close in observance of the holidays. The market will reopen at the Rohde Center for the Arts Saturday, January 7th at 10 and close for the day at 2. For more, visit KenoshaHarborMarket.com.
The celebration of the Christmas season. WPR is pleased to support cultural celebrations from around the world. More information at WPR.org/events.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich is seeking an early release from federal prison. He's submitted a request to President Obama. Blagojevich is in the fourth year of a 14-year sentence for corruption. A small nation in Africa is restoring diplomatic relations with China. NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports on what it means for Taiwan.
Tomei switched its diplomatic recognition to Taiwan in 1997, and today it switched it back to China. China is suspicious of Taiwan's ruling party, which has traditionally been in favor of independence, so Beijing has been heaping pressure on Taipei in a bid to isolate it diplomatically. Only 21 foreign governments now have official ties with Taiwan.
Thousands of demonstrators are in Taiwan's capital, where a parliamentary committee is considering proposals to legalize same-sex marriage. The BBC's Cindy Su is in Taipei.
Chanting, "Marriage should be decided by everyone," and "Stop the review, hold a referendum," opponents of legalizing same-sex marriages protested outside parliament. The opponents, made up partly of religious groups, say legalizing gay marriages would change the nature of families, cause schools to teach children about homosexuality, and lead to more young people experimenting with being gay.
There's no trading today on Wall Street. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News, in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:20. I'm Maureen McCollum. To better track drug abuse, Milwaukee is creating what organizers describe as the nation's largest surveillance system for opioid overdoses. Shemaine Mills reports.
Right now, there's no single place in Milwaukee County where overdose data is kept. Paramedics respond to an overdose. The medical examiner does an autopsy. The state justice department collects statistics. But all this information is not in one system where it can be shared. Liz Sutterfield is with the Advancing a Healthier Wisconsin Endowment. That group is spending nearly $300,000 to coordinate opioid data.
So by combining the three sets of data into one database, it's more nimble, people can be more responsive, and it is more timely.
Sutterfield says compiling the data will hopefully better enable them to intervene and help addicts earlier. Shemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Efforts are underway to preserve a part of Chippewa Falls' lumber history that was taken from the Chippewa River 8 years ago. The Chippewa Herald reports a boom log that washed up against the Chippewa Falls hydro plant dam in September of 2008 has been on display in a downtown park since. But the area the park it was kept in was somewhat shaded and prone to flooding, causing the log to deteriorate. Arlie Engel, a former Chippewa County Historical Society vice president, estimated that the boom log was about 170 years old when it was pulled from the river. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Emily and Antoine Van Achtmeel, supporting New Futures, which works to help low-income D.C. area youth graduate from community college or certificate programs and become financially self-sufficient. Information is available at newfuturesdc.org. From Jones Day, an integrated partnership collaboratively providing legal services for more than a century. 44 offices, 5 continents, serving clients as one firm worldwide. Learn more at jonesday.com. From care.com, offering home pay, a solution for nanny payroll, tax, and HR obligations, from automatic payments to preparing state and federal tax returns. Learn more at care.com/homepay. And from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green. Being Catholic in China can be pretty complicated. The Vatican and Beijing cut ties 2 years after communists took control of China in 1949. And since then, Chinese Catholics have been divided. Some attend government-run churches, others unofficial ones. Well, now there are signs the two sides might be close to reaching a historic deal. Here's NPR's Rob Schmitz.
There are around 12 million Catholics in China, less than 1% of China's population. It's a number you feel at a weekday morning mass inside Shanghai's St. Peter's Church, where a small percentage of pew space is occupied by a few loyal parishioners. But for how small the Catholic population is in China, a potential deal between the Vatican and China's government has been big news in recent weeks. Since becoming the head of the Holy See in 2013, Pope Francis has shown an interest in China. He said he wants to visit the country. He sent a telegram to Chinese President Xi Jinping, and the two sides have reportedly met at least 4 times this year to try and settle differences that go back decades. Only in China do we have a problem like this, says Mrs. Xia after Mass in downtown Shanghai. She says China is unique in this sense because Beijing doesn't want foreign control of its churches. Xia, who only gives me her surname because she's scared of getting in trouble with the authorities, attends both official and unofficial churches in Shanghai. She says the fundamental disagreement is about who gets to choose clergy inside of China.
It's complicated if only the government gets to choose bishops, but the government has a hard time understanding the rules of the Catholic Church.
What's clear is that both Beijing and the Vatican seem to want to come to an agreement. So says Renyan Li, an expert on Chinese Catholics at the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences in Beijing.
In the past, the Vatican seemed more eager to talk, but now the Chinese side is more interested. China wants to improve its international reputation.
Ren says for China, this is an issue of face. And you might think that for the Vatican, the appeal would be China's 1.3 billion souls and the potential to attract them. But Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Ian Johnson says it's more than that. Johnson, the author of the forthcoming book, The Souls of China, The Return of Religion After Mao, says this is primarily about souls that are already with the church.
It's a way to help Catholics in China so that they're part of a legitimate church. And I think from Beijing's point of view, it's a way to make sure that this small but perhaps influential group of Chinese is under some sort of structures that the party can feel comfortable with. They don't like having an underground church.
Officially, there are 8 Chinese-appointed bishops who the Vatican doesn't recognize, and there are 30 Vatican-approved bishops that China won't recognize. And then there are those like Dong Guanhua, bishops that neither side recognizes.
All my parishioners are fine with it. They can tell between what's real and what isn't. They're seeking the true spirit.
Dong is a self-ordained bishop in rural Zhengding County in northern Hebei Province. He runs an unofficial Catholic church out of his home. He has 1,000 parishioners, far more than the official church down the road. That can be a problem sometimes, like when foreign journalists come to interview him. The police took me on a trip for a few days, Dong tells me, laughing. They detained me over the weekend. They've tapped my phone, and they're listening to us now, he says, giggling. When I mentioned the possibility of the government having the last laugh, in other words, the possibility of Beijing striking a deal with the Vatican, he stops laughing. I take orders from the Vatican. If an agreement is made, says Dong, I'll stop working or do whatever the Vatican asks. Those with knowledge of the talks between the Vatican and Beijing have said an agreement could come soon and that it would likely allow Beijing to choose candidates for bishops whom the Vatican would then approve or veto. Back outside St. Peter's Church in downtown Shanghai, parishioner Xia says she's praying for a good outcome.
We can only pray each day that the government understands and respects church rules, but it's hard for the government to accept change.
She says she prays that God will wake up China's government. Rob Schmitz, NPR News, Shanghai.
And let's go now to Israel, where people are still absorbing a U.S. decision not to cast a veto at the U.N. Security Council last week. For the first time, the United States allowed a resolution to pass, which is critical of Jewish settlement activity on the Israeli-occupied West Bank. All this is a closing chapter in a sour relationship between Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and President Obama. NPR's Daniel Estrin reports from Jerusalem.
Netanyahu opened his cabinet meeting Sunday with an accusation. He said the Obama administration orchestrated the UN Security Council resolution behind the scenes.
As I told John Kerry on Thursday, friends don't take friends to the Security Council.
Egypt initially proposed the resolution. U.S. officials deny involvement. But the White House said it let the resolution pass to reflect the international consensus that there is no legal validity to Israeli settlements in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, lands that Israel captured in 1967, and that the international community want to see as part of a Palestinian state under a peace agreement. The Israeli leader said the fate of settlements should not be dictated by the UN, and he said he spoke with U.S. lawmakers who agree.
I'm encouraged by the statements of our friends in the United States, Republicans and Democrats alike. They understand how reckless and destructive this UN resolution was.
That includes President-elect Donald Trump, who called on Obama to veto the resolution.
I look forward to working with those friends and with the new administration when it takes office next month.
Netanyahu took the rare step of summoning the U.S. ambassador to Israel to protest the U.S. role in the resolution. Opposition lawmakers say Netanyahu brought on the U.N. resolution with his recent moves to accommodate Israeli settlers. Right-wing members of Netanyahu's government say Israel's response should be to give up on the idea of a Palestinian state and annex the West Bank.
Blow
No, Culture Minister Miri Regev told Israel Army Radio, the West Bank is not under dispute. It's directly connected to Jewish heritage. Netanyahu echoed that sentiment when he lit Hanukkah candles last night at the Western Wall, the Jewish holy site in Jerusalem that Israel captured in 1967. The Western Wall is not occupied, Netanyahu said. The other places are not occupied either. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Jerusalem.
This is NPR News.
Dawn Tichel and her husband dreamed of owning their own home. Now, their mobile home community is crumbling.
We were without water for 90 days.
But they did bring outhouses out here.
Wait a minute, so you'd have to go to an outhouse when it's 0 degree weather?
Yes.
I'm Ari Shapiro, an investigation into management and neglect. Trailer Park Life, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Tune into All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 today here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. It is 8:30 on this Monday, and you're listening to Morning Edition on WPR. I'm Maureen McCollum. Thank you so much for joining us, and stay tuned. Coming up this hour, we'll look back on Pope Francis and the Catholic Church this year. That story and interview coming up in about 15 minutes. In Wisconsin news, a dissenting opinion by a federal appeals court judge on police use of a secret cell phone tracking technology has convinced a Milwaukee man to take his case a step further. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reports that attorneys for Damian Patrick filed a petition asking for a rehearing in front of the full U.S. Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, following a split decision in November by the court's three-judge panel. It's the first time the use of cell tower stimulators, known as stingrays, have reached a federal appellate court. A U.S. House committee report said clearer guidelines are needed for law enforcement's use of secretive and intrusive cell phone tracking technology, and police and federal agents should be upfront with a judge about their deployment. A former dog track in western Wisconsin may be converted into a baseball stadium and business park. The Hudson City Council is considering a development plan for the former St. Croix Meadows dog track that closed in 2001. The La Crosse Tribune reports that the Minnesota-based KF Investments is looking at developing the 131-acre site into the Northwoods League baseball field and a mix of office and residential developments, including high-end townhouses and corporate headquarters. The property is for sale for nearly $8 million and has not yet been purchased. This is WPR News.
Morning Edition. All Things Considered. Simply Folk. These programs and many more are possible thanks to listener support. You can learn about WPR programs, schedules, and so much more at WPR.org.
Support for WGTD comes from Andrea's. With homemade soups, salads, and sandwiches being served daily at their historic soda fountain. Stop by Andrea's today for lunch and an old-fashioned soda.
Foggy morning in parts of southern Wisconsin today. There is a chance of light rain and light snow in the northwest throughout the day today. Highs will range from the mid-30s in northwestern Wisconsin to the mid to upper 40s in the southeastern part of the state.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Focus Features, presenting A Monster Calls, a film about a boy dealing with the complications of life. He finds a most unlikely ally with the monster, voiced by Liam Neeson, who guides him on a journey of courage, faith, and trust, now playing in select theaters. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, working to preserve wilderness, restore biodiversity, and increase understanding of ocean ecology. More information is available at pewtrusts.org. And from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green. Tis the day after Christmas, and all through the house, many kids probably are not stirring because they're joyfully lost in digital devices. Many parents know that well. Maybe the kids are playing with that new app or game on their smartphone, maybe computer, tablet, smart TV. Perfectly fine today. It's a holiday, but experts caution against too much screen time for children, especially younger children. And there have been some changes in their thinking this year, and let's talk about that with NPR's Eric Westervelt from the NPR Ed team. He's on the line. Hey, Eric.
Hey, David.
So what exactly are experts saying or updating when it comes to these guidelines?
The American Academy of Pediatrics pulled back this year from what had been a really long-standing recommendation. They came out with it way back in 1999, that children under age 2 shouldn't have any screen time. They updated that based on research and the reality that screens are everywhere in people's lives all the time. Now the organization still suggests no screen time is ideal for children under 18 months, except for things like video chats with grandma. But for kids in general, 18 to 2 years, the Academy switched and said, we need to focus now on what's on the screen and who else is in the room. The recommendation now is to avoid solo screen time with children in that age group. The idea is to treat screen time more like reading a book. You should have a parent or caregiver there, present, interacting, pointing out what's on the screen, talking to the toddler.
Or talking to grandma.
Right. FaceTime and Skype don't count.
Right. Well, what about as kids get older? I mean, like ages 2, 3, 4, 5?
Well, the Academy recommends for that group no more than an hour of screen time a day. And as with the younger children recommendations, the Academy says, look, it's important to try to have a parent or caregiver be present. That engagement aspect is key.
Eric, I could hear parents hearing this and being like, that's all well and good, but in day-to-day life, it is so hard to figure out how to make the rules at home, how to enforce the rules, when it's okay to be flexible. I mean, this is tough stuff.
It is indeed. I mean, enforcing an hour of screen time in the real world, many parents might say, it's just not happening. And we heard a lot about that challenge when we got a group of parents together at an NPR Generation Listen event in New York City recently. For example, some educators and experts suggest parents should, as much as possible, try to help curate their children's digital lives to help them tap into what's fun and creative and not just use a device as a babysitter. But Justin Krasner, a father of two children, a 7-year-old and a 3-year-old, says he isn't sure that's realistic.
I feel like if I can just get them out the door with pants on, it feels like we've won the morning. So I feel overwhelmed at the prospect of trying to curate my kids' digital experience.
The bar is low. Just get the kids out with the pants on.
Right, the breakfast challenge, get them out the door. I mean, it is tough. We talked to even experts who study this very issue of youth, families, and screen time. Amanda Lenhart does that for a living. She has 4 daughters, and she says, look, even I have a tough time putting my research recommendations into practice.
I don't think there are easy answers. The literature hasn't caught up. And the truth of it is, a lot of times what I think we find is that we get all these great ideas from literature, but then putting it into practice is really, really difficult given the modern lives that we lead, whether it's that your kids won't touch a carrot from, you know, 20 feet away, or that you really just need 25 minutes and so you put your kid in front of the screen so that you can get that time.
And are we spending more time on devices as time goes on, I would imagine?
Right. There was a recent study out by Common Sense Media that said people with children spend, on average, almost 9.5 hours a day in front of a screen.
Oh, the parents. These are the parents we're talking about.
Yeah. You know, here's the thing. 80% of parents in that study also said, we think we're modeling good behavior for screen time and watching habits for their kids. But there's a bit of hypocrisy there. I mean, I'm guilty of it in my own house. My daughter calls me out on it and says, you tell me I can't use the iPad anymore, but, you know, you're on your phone all the time. You're checking email. And she's right. I'm busted. You know, do I really have to retweet Don Gagne right then? No, I can wait.
Our colleague Don Gagne, I would retweet him anytime. That is valuable screen time, I would say. But set a better example in other places, Eric.
I'm going to try, David.
All right, NPR's Eric Westervelt for the NPR Ed team. Thanks a lot, Eric.
Thank you, David.
All right, you might know this from your own time traveling. If you want to learn about a place, find the local bar and talk to the bartender. NPR international correspondents are doing just that all this week as we head toward New Year's Eve. We start today in the Kurdistan region of northern Iraq, not far from the Iranian border, is the only jazz club around for thousands of miles. Kurdish entrepreneur Chilak Salar opened Uptown Jazz last year in the Kurdish region's second biggest city, Sulaymaniyah. NPR's Jane Arraf paid a visit.
There's a cool blue light behind the glass shelves of bottles over the granite bar. A candle drips wax on a grand piano. There are more than a dozen booths and tables set with gleaming white tablecloths. Framed posters of John Coltrane and other jazz greats. But there are only 5 or 6 customers here, and this is a typical night.
The worst year ever I've experienced in my life, you can see. All what happens around here in Kurdistan, in Iraq, in Syria, and the worst year ever.
There's a saying in Kurdish and Arabic that basically says, if you think yesterday was bad, wait until you see how much worse tomorrow will be. ISIS entered Iraq 2 years ago. So when Salar says that this was the worst year ever, That's saying a lot.
The reason I stayed in Kurdistan and I didn't go back to London, because I lived in London for 13 years. I felt it's cowardly, you know, to go back, to leave my people and all this. I said I have to stay open and to work with my staff and just let's hope for better.
Even in this Muslim country, there are quite a lot of people who drink. But most people can't afford to go out these days. And much worse, it's a country at war. And while they're driving out ISIS, Iraqi and Kurdish soldiers are dying on the front. It's going to be a subdued New Year's. You're more likely in this region to see a bottle of whiskey or vodka on the table than a round of cocktails. But Salar mixes one up.
I like Blue Margarita. That's one of my favorites.
This is Salar's New Year's wish.
I wish that every single person on this planet Earth to have a peace, to have a good life. And I can say especially for my people, we're really tired.
Not just for the Kurds, he says, but for the Iraqis and the Syrians and the Turks. An end to the bad years. Jane Araf, NPR News, Sulaymaniyah, Iraq.
Oh, that's so good.
Really?
That's fantastic.
Good. Great. Good to hear that.
This is NPR News.
It is 8:41 on this Monday morning. Thank you so much for listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. Up next, it's the latest headlines, and in 10 minutes on Morning Edition. Since 2007, mashup artist Jordan Roseman, better known as DJ Earworm, has taken the top 25 songs of the year and woven them into a single track. He calls it the United States of Pop. Ahead, we hear 2016's version. That in 10 minutes.
Listener support makes Wisconsin Public Radio the great radio service it is. The one you count on for trustworthy news, statewide discussions, inspiring music, and laughter. As the year draws to a close, consider the value you get from Wisconsin Public Radio. Make your tax-deductible year-end gift right now. Go to WPR.org, and in minutes, you will have done a great thing. Thanks.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. A blizzard warning is posted across much of the Dakotas and eastern Montana. The National Weather Service says strong winds and more than a foot of snow are expected before the end of the day.
This area is the bullseye with 12 to 18 inches of snow through today, and it will be tapering off snow-wise here midday, but the winds will continue.
That's meteorologist Dan Riddle at the National Weather Service in Grand Forks, North Dakota. Fragments of wreckage have been recovered in the Black Sea after the crash of a Russian military plane with 92 people aboard. There were no survivors. The plane went down yesterday shortly after taking off from Sochi. The flight originated in Moscow and had stopped in Sochi to refuel. Most of those killed were members of the Russian Army Choir. They were on their way to Syria for a New Year's performance. Heart failure has claimed the life of British pop singer George Michael. 'Cause I gotta have faith. I gotta have faith. His publicist says Michael had not been ill before his death at age 53, though he battled depression and drugs during his lifetime. Michael sold more than 100 million albums over his career. He burst onto the music charts in the 1980s as half of the pop duo Wham. Fellow musician Elton John remembers Michael as a brilliant artist. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:43. I'm Maureen McCollum. A UW-Madison survey found independent voters are less likely than Democrats and Republicans to vote for a female candidate. Surveyors were given different sets of hypothetical candidates with varied characteristics and sexes to compare. When independents had to pick between a man and a woman, a female candidate got about 4 percentage points less of the vote compared to the survey's average of 2.5 percentage points. Co-author Barry Burden says he doesn't know why for sure independents voted this way in the survey, but he does have a theory.
Because they don't have a connection to one of the major political parties, they end up relying on the traits of the candidates much more than Democrats and Republicans do.
A second survey found about 13% of the national public does not like the idea of having a female president. Authorities say two Milwaukee police officers were injured after being struck by a stolen vehicle. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reports that officers were treated at a hospital and released after the Saturday incident. Police say two 16-year-old Milwaukee boys are accused of breaking into a U.S. Postal Service vehicle and stealing items along with keys from another car. The teens were arrested after a short foot chase. They face charges that include motor vehicle theft and recklessly endangering safety. This is Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from ADT Security, helping to protect families and homes for over 140 years. Learn more at ADT.com. From Care.com, offering home pay, a solution for nanny payroll, tax, and HR obligations. From automatic payments to preparing state and federal tax returns. Learn more at Care.com/home pay. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working with others to build a culture of health for all. On the web at rwjf.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning, I'm David Green. Pope Francis turned 80 years old a few days ago, but advancing age, if anything, seems to be driving him with greater urgency. This past year, the Pope focused on refugees, on Christian unity, and also controversial reform within the church itself. And let's talk about the Pope's year and his plans for 2017 with NPR's Sylvia Pagioli, who's on the line from Rome. Sylvia, good morning.
Good morning, David.
So let's just look back. I mean, this year began with a trip to Mexico by the Pope that really made it clear that he was willing to wade into politics, right?
Absolutely. He symbolically took the migrant south-north route to the United States by going to Ciudad Juarez on the border with Texas. And there he spoke of the human dignity of immigrants. And on his flight home, asked about Donald Trump, Francis said, "A person who thinks only about building walls and not building bridges is not Christian." A remark you might remember that Trump described as disgraceful.
Yeah.
And then he continued to focus on migrants, visiting the Greek island of Lesbos, which was the front line of the European migrant crisis. And a month later, he accepted a prestigious European Union prize, but he scolded Europe for its treatment of migrants. And in a speech echoing Martin Luther King, he said, "I have a dream of a Europe where being a migrant is not a crime." So, yeah, he showed he can be quite outspoken on political issues.
You know, I hear you mentioned building bridges. One thing he has really focused on is Christian unity. Can you explain exactly what that is and what he's done?
Well, he did something this year that both his two predecessors had failed to do, John Paul II and Benedict. Francis met with the Russian Patriarch of the Orthodox Church, and his most recent trip was to Sweden, where he commemorated the 500th anniversary of the Protestant Reformation. That had triggered one of the biggest splits in Christianity and decades of religious wars. He went so far as to praise Luther, who was once considered a heretic in the church, as a great reformer. So what he's been doing with other Christian churches is trying to heal past wounds and work together toward a shared view of their history.
So interesting, though, a lot of the criticism he has gotten as he's been doing many of these things has been from within. I mean, I think back to that document he issued in the spring about families, and that triggered a lot of criticism from conservatives within the church.
Absolutely. One footnote says that divorced and remarried faithful who are not recognized by the Catholic Church because it upholds the indissolubility of marriage might in some particular cases have access to the sacraments. In the fall, a group of four cardinals wrote to Francis accusing him of sowing confusion on important moral issues, and they asked for clarifications. He did not reply, and one of the signatories, the American cardinal Raymond Burke, said if the Pope does not clarify, he will proceed with what he called a formal correction of the Pope after Christmas. Hmm. Now, that's very close to outright dissent. But I think Francis intends to forge ahead with his reform agenda. Last week, in his Christmas greetings to Vatican administrators, he lashed out against what he called malevolent resistance to his reforms.
Okay, so which suggests maybe more of the same as we get into the new year.
Absolutely. One of the topics that he wants to raise, according to many Vatican analysts, is given the shortage of worldwide shortage of priests, is the possibility of a married priesthood. But he needs more backing from his bishops right now. In the meantime, there are going to be preparations this coming year for a bishops meeting in 2018 on the topic of youth and vocations. And that's where the idea of a married clergy could come up, and that could open up all sorts of other taboo topics, such as the role of women in the church. So we have a pope who's very popular among the Catholic faithful and non-Catholics, but there's no doubt he's going to continue to face resistance from conservatives inside the church.
Okay, speaking to our colleague NPR Sylvia Pajoli in Rome. Sylvia, thanks.
Thank you, David.
This is NPR News.
It is 10 minutes before 9 o'clock. Thank you so much for listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay with us. Morning Classic starts in about 10 minutes. Peter Bryant will be filling in for Stephanie Elkins this week.
Support for WGTD comes from the staff of Piasecki Althaus Funeral Home, who understand the holidays can seem hopeless, but there is hope, help, and support by texting HOPELINE to 741741. Someone will listen or be a resource for you to give you help and hope. Text HOPELINE to 741741.
To give voice to those who cannot be heard and to bring their world to you, because their world is your world. This is NPR.
It's a foggy morning in parts of southeast Wisconsin today. There is a chance of light rain and light snow in the northwest starting this morning and continuing into the day. Temperatures will range across Wisconsin from the mid-30s in the northwest to the mid to upper 40s in southeast Wisconsin.
Thank you to the business sponsors who help support WPR programs. Businesses like the Chippewa Valley Cultural Center and the Madison Symphony Orchestra. Become a business sponsor. Go to WPR.org/sponsor.
Support for WGTD comes from Carthage College, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. More information is available online at carthage.edu/grad.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green. The Underground Railroad has been on America's mind this year. It was the backdrop of a novel called The Underground Railroad that won this year's National Book Award in Fiction, and it was the setting for Underground, an acclaimed new television drama.
We have to go now.
No, we can't. We got the plan.
The upcoming second season adds a new character, and she's based on a real historical figure whose story has been underrepresented in movies and television. Here's NPR's Netta Ulaby.
Underground is filled with wild chases and captures.
Wanted, 7 escaped slaves.
7 runaways flee a Georgia plantation in 1857 through a treacherous world filled with slave owners, double-crossing slave catchers, double-crossing abolitionists, and enslaved people double-crossing each other.
I trusted you. Now my family's torn apart. They got my pearly maid. They got her.
The first season ends with one of the show's main characters, a runaway maid trying to save her friends, meeting a new character, a dark-skinned woman wielding a rifle.
They said you was looking to steal slaves.
Can't steal something that ain't property in the first place.
Well, I aim to teach you how. Name's Harriet.
Harriet Tubman.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
Veronica Wells, culture editor of the website Madame Noir, is one of the millions of Underground fans so excited about the new Harriet Tubman character, she can't stop saying how excited she is.
I'm so excited. I'm so excited about Harriet Tubman because she doesn't play. She doesn't take any mess.
Harriet Tubman helped more than 100 people find freedom a decade before the Civil War.
The Lord sent you to me to get your family back.
But until now, this intensely dramatic character has barely been featured on screen. Besides a miniseries from 1978, A Woman Called Moses, starring Cecily Tyson.
I will lead my people out of bondage, Lord.
No surprise, says Madame Noir editor Veronica Wells.
She's a black woman, and there haven't been a lot of stories for black women of any time period.
And that's why Wells is excited to see more of Harriet Tubman on the future $20 bill and an upcoming movie starring Viola Davis. On the WGN show Underground, Tubman is played by actress Aisha Hines. When she first stepped on set, Hines, a seasoned theater professional, burst into tears.
Even now, oh my God, even I get so emotional about it.
Hines did her research and learned Harriet Tubman's nearly superhuman courage came from her total confidence that God was advising her and listening to her.
Trying to dig deep for that level of faith just completely broke me. You know, I felt unworthy. I felt incapable of really, truly honoring the story that she had to tell.
So to play an icon, Hines searched for smaller truths to make Tubman human.
How does she peel potatoes in the kitchen? You know, just simple things that you forget to remember about a person.
Actress Aisha Hines believes there's a reason why Harriet Tubman's story feels so relevant right now.
I think we're in a time that calls for that level of courage, that level of resolve, you know, to be completely disgusted with injustice to the point that you will have to take some huge leaps of faith, and it may take one person leading many.
When the real Harriet Tubman died in 1913, it was in a home for African-American seniors she'd established years earlier. Her final words, "I go to prepare a place for you." Netta Ulibi, NPR News.
Okay, let's hear what really sounds like a time capsule from the year 2007. A DJ who goes by the name DJ Earworm took the top 25 songs from that year, wove them together, and called the result United State of Pop. He's been doing this every year since.
Every single sound you hear comes from one of these 25 songs. I'll look up all of the lyrics for all the songs, and I put them on a single document, and I'll sort of scan through the document and try to identify my main thesis.
Okay, so what about 2016? This year's mix is DJ Earworm's 10th, and he called it Into Pieces. DJ Earworm says he tries to capture the feel of a year, and he says 2016 was rough.
With our fractured political climate, with, you know, increased tension between police and Black Lives Matter and all sorts of things, we lost so many people that we loved this year.
So to pull off United State of Pop 2016, DJ Earworm sliced and diced vocals from the R&B star The Weeknd and his song Starboy.
It was just an irresistible way to start. Whenever I see the word year, I always say, oh. And then other lyrics talk about,
I'm trying to put you in the worst mood.
And so I thought, well, the year actually is what put you in the worst mood. If the sentences don't exist, I try to build them from the individual phrases and see if I can get something that creates the sentiment so that it goes from darkness into light. You know, it gives you an emotional journey. Did not want to have a negative message with slow music, so I chose the one upbeat song that was huge this year, which is This Is What You Came For, and so I took that dance tempo to be a lot of the background to liven the whole thing up.
All that I'm wishing for my friends.
Into Pieces, I wanted to have the repetition of that to make it catchy. But also, I liked it because it was about my artistic method. I cut things into pieces, but also it very much feels like our world is fracturing. Oh yeah, that's the dark part. There was an opportunity to lose the drums for a minute, so we can have a little breather before it starts up again, start to build the tension.
I cut them all loose and then we're free.
So yeah, we end with Lucas Graham. In 7 years, he's talking about his whole life story, and it has a very nostalgic feel. And he ends it with, this very sad piano. All I know, I can't stop. You know, if things are really bad, what can you do? You have to soldier on. It was
a big, big world. DJ Earworm, we hope he never stops doing this. His year-end mashup, United State of Pop is on YouTube. And you heard it here on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And tune in for Morning Edition every weekday from 5 until 9 here on Wisconsin Public Radio. And join us later today for the day's news on All Things Considered from NPR. That gets underway at 4. And just before that, BBC World News.
Support for WPR comes from Titletown Brewing Company in Green Bay, now offering a variety of bottled beers throughout Wisconsin. More about their beers, historic facilities, and newly renovated brewery is at TitletownBrewing.com.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, Katy Park's annual Ice Fishing Derby will take place the morning of January 21st. The event gives kids the opportunity to ice fish with experienced adults, as well as join in special activities including snowshoeing, cross-country skiing, and hiking. You're listening to WGTD HD.